Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Hey there, we're Corinne Vienne and Sabrina Deanna Roga here to introduce our newest podcast, Crimes Of, a Crime House original.
Crimes Of is a weekly series that explores a new theme each season, from crimes of the paranormal, unsolved murders, and more. Our first season is Crimes Of Infamy, the true crime stories behind Hollywood's most iconic horror villains.
Listen to and follow Crimes Of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another edition of Backstage Chicago. I'm Lisa Fielding. Ordinarily, we'd take you behind the scenes with an actor, an entertainer, a singer, a dancer, or tell you about the latest hot stage show. But today, we go backstage with someone a little different. Someone who hangs out with dinosaurs, loves punk rock, and travels the world, discovering and studying artifacts and fossils for the Field Museum.
So here you guys are looking at bones of a fossil bird called Hesperornis. Hesperornis has very special...
She's close personal friends with Sue the T-Rex and studies prehistoric birds and reptiles for a living.
I'm the associate curator of fossil reptiles, a.k.a. the dinosaur curator.
Jigme O'Connor is a scientist and a paleontologist at the Field Museum, one of the few women in the industry.
Well, normally you are a child who has loved dinosaurs and nothing else your entire life, and then you work really, really hard, and you go to school for a million years, it seems like, and then if you're lucky, if you're very, very lucky, you land a dream job like this. In my case, I got started a little bit late. Actually, my mom went back to school to do her PhD in geology when I was 10, so I became interested in geology, but I didn't know which facet of geology like really clicked with me until I went to college as a geology major, and I took this class by a paleontologist named Dr. Don Prothro, and I just immediately fell in love. And then I applied to a bunch of grad schools, but because I was new to paleo, I didn't know what I loved most, right? I just loved everything. I loved all the fossils. So I applied to all these different programs, and in the end, the one that I got into and chose to go to put me on the path to become an expert on Mesozoic birds. So I kind of fell into the dinosaur thing. I'm not one of these Jurassic Park kids or dinosaur groupies. I really love all fossils, all extinct life, and all living life as well. But the thing is, I didn't want to kill anything to study it. So paleontology is perfect for me.
I don't want to call it a phase, but a lot of kids go through like a dinosaur phase where they're obsessed.
Yeah.
But then they either grow out of it or they continue it their whole life. Do you find that?
Yeah. I mean, 99% of all paleontologists literally have known they wanted to do this since they were little kids. And I really admire that perseverance. You know, I was the kind of kid who never really liked dinosaurs as a kid. I didn't like not like them, but it never really was something I was that interested in. But I went through so many different ideas of what I wanted to do. I want to be a veterinarian. I want to be a teacher. You know, I want to be a movie star, like all these different things. And I found paleo pretty late in life. But, you know, we refer to paleontology and specifically dinosaurs as a gateway science because it's something that captures everybody's imagination and can get you to start asking, like, starting to ask scientific questions. How do we know this about dinosaurs just from looking at one fragment of one part of their skeleton? And then you start to understand how science works, and hopefully you get excited about science, and you get excited about learning and discovering about the world around you, and that's really what we hope for.
She's been working behind the scenes at the Field Museum for about 2 years, but spent more than 10 years in Beijing at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology. She's traveled the world on digs and does research about what lived and died millions of years ago.
Do you go out on site and stuff?
Yeah, I do.
Like, you know, the Indiana Jones type thing?
Yes, yes, I do. Yeah, actually, my friend who I do field work with, he calls himself Ekalaka Jones because he's from this town called Ekalaka, and that's where a lot of Hell Creek exposures are. Actually, also Pierre Shale, where you find Hesperornis. And so we do most of our field work in the summer because that's when the weather is on our side. So this summer, I spent 2 weeks out in the Hell Creek looking for little things like birds. We were actually lucky enough to find some, as well as other rare things like snakes, lizards, even this tiny little frog skull that's like 2 millimeters wide. I mean, it was pretty crazy. And I also did some work up in Dinosaur Provincial Park up in Canada. So for all you dinosaur fans out there, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. I highly recommend going because I've never been any place in my life like it. There's literally fossil everywhere, just everywhere. Like the first fossil I found there, just walking, you know, along a path, just picked up a tooth of a T-Rex. A Tyrannosaur, probably something like Gorgosaurus. But it was just amazing. And there's fossils like this, like these like partial vertebrae everywhere. And our leader, this Canadian who we were collaborating with, was like, don't touch it, leave it. We have too much of that stuff. Like we only pick up the really exceptional stuff. And so hard to like walk by all these dinosaur bones and be like, don't touch them, don't collect them, because you know, you don't see places like that every day.
We're in Canada.
So this is it's a couple hours from Calgary, so it's in Alberta, which is also a fun fact that I learned while I was there, totally random. It's a rat free. It's the only place in the world where there's no rats, Alberta. So they claim anyways. Yeah, exactly.
Was that the coolest place you've ever been and the coolest fossil you found?
I think Mongolia is probably the coolest place I've ever been. I mean, that was just an incredible expedition. I was there with the American Museum of Natural History. They do that. You know, they've been going there for like every year for like 100 years, right? And so, you know, we were there for a whole month. We traveled a huge portion of Mongolia. We were, you know, driving for like 3 weeks and then collecting fossils only for like 10 days, maybe, like driving for a couple days and go to a fossil locality. And it was just spectacular. I mean, the geology, the views, it was beautiful. The people are so interesting, you know, like picked up a little Mongolian, had a really good time with my friends, and we found fossils.
Speaking of fossils, she's even named dozens of different species.
So this one here is a cast of a species that I named after Greg Graffin, who's the lead singer of Bad Religion. It's called Chelenia graffini. It is in the book. They left out the Bad Religion part, but that's fine. They're like, oh, you know. But yeah, that's like one of the perks of being a scientist, or at least a zoologist who gets to name species. And so, I think I've named over 40 different species of birds and dinosaurs and a couple lizards, one by accident, one on purpose.
How do you consider like what to name them?
Well, so unfortunately, I have co-authors who don't let me just name them whatever I want. So usually I'm very traditional about it. Like I use Latin. And for example, this bird lizard I named Oculodentavis, which means toothed eye bird. Now we know it's not a bird, but that's going to be its name forever. Sorry. But this is just something that happens all the time. But so this one was really the only one I was able to, you know, name after a band. But there definitely are some other celebs out there that I'm just like waiting until I get the freedom to name something whatever I want, and then Keanu Reeves, I'm going to name a species after you.
O'Connor spends her days between her four-room lab and the Collection Research Center located deep in the bowels of the museum, where thousands of fossils are kept and preserved.
In the Collections Resource Center in the bowels of the Field Museum. That's all I got.
So tell us where we are. Katie was mentioning kind of trying to visualize where we are and the specifics, dynamics of this to preserve what you have here.
So we are in the Collection Resource Center, which is where we keep most of all the specimens in the Field Museum collections, not just fossils. But this particular room is the oversized vertebrate fossil collection room, so it is mostly really large things like dinosaurs, but not exclusively. So for example, when I show you around, you'll see some early reptiles and even some mammal ichnofossils, trace fossils, in the back there, along with some marine reptiles that are not dinosaurs, though they get commonly misidentified as such. So where we actually are is almost in between the museum and Schulzer Field.
Okay.
This is where we keep all the fossils. It is a little bit of a hike from our offices, but it's good. You know, most of us academics are just sitting behind our computers all the time, so it's good to get a little bit of exercise. So anything that we are working on actively, we would drag or haul back up to our office where we can work on it, you know, where it's more convenient for working on it. Here, so basically nothing in here I'm actively working on. All that stuff you'll see in my office when we go upstairs. Things are pretty much organized by size. So here on the shelves, you have really big things. And then within this, all the big things on shelves, you do, everything is grouped according to, like, it's taxonomic grouping. So all the first couple shelves are your sauropod dinosaurs, your large, long-necked things. And then moving on, you have theropod dinosaurs, then going into ornithischian dinosaurs, and then you have, like, miscellaneous right at the end. And then everything else that is that will fit in these cabinets goes into these compactorized cabinet shelves. So you see that they're on tracks. So basically, this allows us to put as many cabinets in a room as possible without, because you're not saving room for aisles. So everything is, you know, if you need to create an aisle to get access to one of these cabinets, you just roll the cabinets back. And this is something that little kids love doing when I take them on tours. And then these things are organized taxonomically as well. So for example, this row of cabinets here is mostly birds, which is very convenient for me. So I just come straight in. I don't have to go very far. I can just access the birds and leave. But yeah, everything else you'll see has labels on the cabinet so you can see exactly what's inside it.
Although prehistoric birds are her specialty, she even wrote a paper about the field's most famous resident.
Recently, I actually published my first paper on Sue the T-Rex because, you know, why not? You know, I never thought I would work on Tyrannosaurus rex, but you come to the Field Museum, you have the best specimen of the world. Might as well utilize it, right? So if you go up to the Sioux Hall, you'll see that it has these weird holes in its jaw, and nobody knows what caused them. But there had been the hypothesis that it was caused by this protozoan infection, and even put forth that this protozoan infection caused Sue's throat to swell up so that she starved, it starved to death. And so I kind of looked into that, and basically what I said is like, look, it was not a protozoan infection. What caused these holes? I don't know. I really don't know, but it wasn't a protozoan infection. So not very helpful, but the fact that it's so mysterious that I genuinely have no clue what caused these holes is actually really exciting to me, you know? Like, that's what I love about paleontology, are all these mysteries, you know? We have all these weird organisms that we look at their skeleton and we literally have no clue what they were doing with their tiny arms or their, like, weird tail. And that's why I think paleontology is a lot of fun.
But we don't know everything. There are still some big questions out there. What were those tiny arms used for?
Little arm MRI, right?
Don't yeah. Big deal. Well, we CT scanned it at the University of Chicago. So, and that was so that we could create a 3D model and do, this is going to sound very fancy, computational biomechanics, which basically means we take the 3D model and we play around with it in different programs to figure out what the range of motion between every joint was. You know, we have to put the cartilage back on, basically, and then look at the range of motion. And then we even look at muscle outputs from, you know, we reconstruct where we think the muscles would go. So yes, adding a lot of error, but it allows us to create a testable hypothesis about what these, you know, diminutive arms were for. As you know, and this is a student project. Like, I put forth a bunch of projects for this particular student. I said, what do you want to work on? And he said, you know, Sue's arms. And I was like, sure, fair enough. So my specialty is birds, but every once in a while through collaborations or through students, I, you know, dabble with non-avian dinosaurs and things like Sue and other cooler beasts.
Another important part of her job is talking to the next generation about her career, about science, and of course, dinosaurs.
I thought I'd ever get to feel a dinosaur
bone. Right? Yeah, and I know everybody wants to touch dinosaur bones, but I'm like, unfortunately, I can't let people touch specimens we use for studying.
Today, she's fielding questions from inquisitive young minds and showing off her new children's book about what else? Birds and dinosaurs.
So my new book is by Quarto Publishing, and it's called When Dinosaurs Conquered the Skies. And it is, well, as it says on the cover, the incredible story of bird evolution. And shortly after I started at the Field Museum, like still during the pandemic when we're kind of stuck at home, this publishing company reached out and said, hey, have you ever thought about writing a kid's book? And they have this series on evolution, and they gave me examples of books that had come out already in the series. And I was so impressed with these books. They're so full of information. Like, even I learned a ton of new things from just perusing this book about human evolution, for example. And so they asked me to do one about the evolution of birds, and I should, why not? And honestly, I had so much fun doing it, and I can't express what a crazy feeling it was when they finally sent me the book, and I, like, held it in my hands. I was like, oh my goodness, like, it was really awesome. And And, you know, it was great to be able to share, like, everything that I've learned since I started studying paleontology. Almost all of it's in there. I kind of joke that once you read this book, like, you can do my job. Like, you know everything I know. But, yeah, so it's the story of how birds are really unique animals, about how they evolved to become this incredibly unique group, and also, you know, at the very end, we talk about the sixth mass extinction and how birds are being affected by human actions.
O'Connor says the book is as much about the future as it is the past, and hopes kids and parents alike learn about climate change, its profound effect on birds, and how humans can do our part to save them and the planet.
Paleontology is my passion in life, but I hope everybody finds their passion. But really, the environment is really in crisis, so everybody's priority should be sustainability. So that's the last two pages of the book is talking about that, about, you know, what the problems are, but if we're the problem, we can be the solution. And also, I provide some solutions, because I really don't want children to read this, become depressed, and to give up hope. You know, we can do this. If we work together and make a few significant, but small but significant changes, we can really turn this around.
Do you find a lot of kids, you know, still introduced into dinosaurs? Like, why do you think people still love them so much?
And dinosaurs are such, like, fascinating creatures. You know, there's nothing like them alive today, and they're such an extreme of form that we don't have like today on our planet. And it's partially because of the megafaunal extinctions that are part of the sixth mass extinction that started many thousands of years ago. But I think, you know, the bizarre shapes and the enormous size of dinosaurs really capture people's imagination. But really, with dinosaurs, like, I don't necessarily want people to become paleontologists. I want people to get excited about the process of discovery, of how you take a clue, maybe it's a fossil, maybe it's a piece of DNA, and how you use that to learn new things, to contribute to human knowledge and be part of that journey. Because, you know, it's something that I do talk about in the book, is that, you know, Newton said it. He said, we stand on the shoulders of giants, which means that all science builds off the science that was done previously. So we're all working together, you know, as part of human history to, you know, gain further insight into the world around us so that we can be better stewards of the planet, but also so we can get off this planet, explore Mars, and do all sorts of cool things. Drive cars, drive flying cars one day, I hope.
One upside to climate change, she says, is that warmer conditions are leading scientists to more prehistoric discoveries around the world.
Now that we're melting all the ice caps, which is not necessarily a good thing, but there's all these woolly mammoths that have actually been not fossilized, but trapped in ice. And so now, as the ice is melting, we're finding actual frozen, thawing out woolly mammoths. And actually, I heard a funny story about, like, Russian explorers who were up in Siberia, and they would find these, like, thawing out woolly mammoths, and they didn't realize that they had been dead for, like, 40,000 years, and they even ate them. there's a lot of really cool, as far as I know, I mean, they're Russian, they're tough as nails.
Back in the Collection Research Center, crews are constantly moving bones and fossils of all sizes. Head of research Bill Simpson maneuvers the forklift to move some of the museum's largest pieces of history.
You saw in the news that we took the arm off of Sue recently, so we put the cast back on while the actual bone was missing, and so now Bill is returning it.
So we're going to use the forklift and put everything back away.
Yeah, because of course all these bones are super, super heavy. I mean, even they're big, but they're also made of stone, so, like, you know, they're a lot heavier than they would have been in real life, so that's why we need this Heister, which I really, like, put an S on the thing, so it says Scheister.
You know, like, what as much as I might be a scientist, so, I like to
what is this here?
What did you just bring in here?
This is the cast of Sue's left scapular coracoid, okay, the shoulder blade.
Okay, now we've heard about this story and what you guys did with this. What are you doing here now? Where is this coming from?
So there's an entire research cast of Sue, which is housed here for research purposes. When we took the real scapular coracoid off for CT scanning, we put the cast on temporarily. The real one's back on the mount, so the cast is going back into collections.
So she's back intact.
Yeah, it's still missing the real arm, which still has more work to be done on it.
But you always have to replace when you take it out, obviously.
Well, not always, but when we can. Generally, we don't have a complete cast of what's on exhibit, but in this case, we do.
O'Connor's passion and enthusiasm for her job shows through.
So here we're looking at bones of a bird called Hesperornis. It was first described by a paleontologist named O.C. Marsh in 1880. So we've known about this bird for a very long time, but You might be surprised to know that there's still a ton that we don't know about this taxon. So it was pretty big, like standing up, if it could stand, another thing we don't know. It probably would have been between 4 and 6 feet high, depending on the particular species. It was completely flightless. It would have lived in shallow marine environments, swimming around with its hind limbs, eating things like squids, fish. It had jaws full of teeth, but then the tip actually would have had a little beak, like a cratinous beak, like what we see in modern birds, that could kind of flex a little bit and do a little pinching motion, something that we don't see at all in any living bird today. So it was a very interesting bird. It's the one bird that we have in our collections. It's also the one bird, or one of the birds in my book, one of the few birds in my book that I haven't actually done any research on myself, but that is going to change soon. I have like 3 different projects open right now in Hesperornis describing new species, trying to look at their bone density to see what that tells us about their environment, and who knows what else.
Whether she's talking about a bird named Hesperornis, a Brachiosaurus, or the cast of Sue the T-Rex arm, she knows her job automatically makes her pretty unique and fields a lot of questions about her career everywhere she goes.
When people ask you what you do for a living, like at a party or something, people freak out when you say,
yeah, they do.
I mean, that's an amazing, you're automatically an amazing, interesting person.
But I get so awkward because I don't want people to think I'm interesting just because of my job. And so people are like, what do you do? And then I know what's going to happen when I tell them. So I definitely start getting like, and I get really awkward. And then I'm like, I'm a curator of the dinosaur the Field Museum. Sometimes I'll say I'm the associate curator of fossil reptiles, but if I just say I'm a curator, then they're like, curator of what? And then I'm like, dinosaurs. And then they're like, oh my God. And like, I mean, I'm totally happy to like, you know, be the, you know, some entertainment at a party and teach people about dinosaurs. But I get really awkward about it because I don't want people to think that I'm interesting just because of what I do. What I do is interesting. It's not me, you know?
But you're so passionate about it. Like, it's infectious. Like, yeah. I'm interested now because of you.
It's a lot of work. So unless you're passionate about it, you don't do it. Because you work 7 days a week. You work 10, 12 hours a day. So if you don't have the passion, then run for your life.
Paleontology is still quite a male-dominated world. Only 19.4% of paleontologists are women, more than 80% men. Although generations of researchers have chipped away at the male-dominated culture, a gap still remains. O'Connor is certainly aware of the gender disparity, but she doesn't see herself as a pioneer, but says she takes pride in the path that has been paved before her and looks forward to championing the profession and the journey for women.
There are a lot of very famous female scientists who have come before me. I'm not going to say that I'm, you know, that... Yeah, I wouldn't even say that I'm I would not even put myself in their ranks yet, you know, like, I mean, I know I was just telling these second graders that I've been doing, you know, like, they were like, how long have you been doing paleo? And I'm like, since I was 19, 20 years. I'm like, oof, I'm getting old. But I don't feel that way. You know, I still feel like young. I don't feel like part of this older, like, you know, made it generation yet. And, but yeah, I, you know, like, there's all this, like, push to diversify science and show that women can do it, that show that anyone from any background can do it. But this was never a concern to me because my mom is the person I followed. I followed in my mom's footsteps. And she was a Chinese immigrant with 4 kids who did her PhD at the age of 40 and immediately got a great job. And, like, she never once... Like, growing up, I never once had the thought that women can't do this, I can't do this, like, you know, that you know, the face of science is supposed to be a white man. Like, that's just not how I was raised. So now, and then I went to China, so that's also not a problem, right? You know, like, you just do not have this systemic racism and misogyny that you have in the United States in a lot of other countries. So again, it wasn't something that really concerned me. And then I came back to the United States, and it's like, wow, you're a woman, you're a minority. And it's like, I don't see myself that way, you know? I just see myself as a person, you know? So, you know, now I realize that how important it is to provide proper role models. I'm super happy to do that. If I have inspired people, then that's great. That's super flattering. But, like, I'm just doing me.
O'Connor even has her own Wikipedia page, listed as one of 137 women in her field. Her bio photo shows off her tattoo sleeve and her bob haircut. She's known as the punk rock paleontologist who makes science fun and flying dinosaurs and ancient birds cool. She says making discoveries is everything.
Now, you spent the world finding different things in China, also in Canada. You were talking about an amazing kind of property, area where you find. What does it feel when you unearth something like this? Even just seeing it right now, if I found that in my backyard, I would be like, whoa.
It is an incredible feeling. I don't know. I can't even explain it. You get this thrill through your body, and it's a chemical reaction. Like when you get so excited, and it's actually addictive. You know, like after you find something, you're like, whoa. You know, then you want to find more, and it'll be like, okay, it's getting dark, you should go home, but you're like, but I want to find more stuff. You know, you kind of have to like peel yourself out of the field and like force yourself to go back. So it is a really, really exciting feeling. It's thrilling. You know, and I really encourage people. You know, like these second graders I was talking to earlier, I was like, you know, they asked, you know, how do I become a paleontologist, or what should I do if I want to be a paleontologist? And one of the things I suggested was like, look up online where you can find fossils. Because, for example, here in Illinois, there's lots of places where you can find invertebrate fossils, the collection of which by amateurs will not affect science negatively. And you can find lots of information online, like, oh, this roadside, you can find rugose corals that lived 400 million years ago or whatever. And you can take your kids there and they can find something and get that thrill of discovery for themselves, you know, to find something on the ground that no other human has ever seen, that organism that lived so long ago that nobody has seen until you know, mm-hmm. and then for you to like, I don't know, pick it up and feel and really think about that. Think about the fact that organism, like what that organism would have experienced when it was alive and what it had to go through to become a fossil, and then what geologic processes had to occur so that it was now brought to the surface so that somebody can find it. And when, mm-hmm. I mean, it's finding a fossil involves so many concepts that are so important, I think, for helping us to really appreciate the natural world. You know, at least in my opinion, it's one of the more fulfilling, you know, career paths that you can choose.
O'Connor's research has been published in Nature, Science, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and Current Biology. And in 2019, she was awarded the Schuchert Award for Excellence in Paleontology under the age of 40. Her new children's book, When Dinosaurs Conquered the Skies, is available online and at the Field Museum bookstore.
See the towering, ferocious, battle-scarred predator that Sue once was.
Thanks to Jing Mae O'Connor, Bill Simpson, Kate Golombeski, Sue the T-Rex, and my producer Ariel Ravine for their contributions to this month's episode. Listen to the Odyssey app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Fielding. Thanks for listening.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Hey there, we're Corinne Vienne and Sabrina Dianaroga here to introduce our newest podcast, Crimes Of, a Crime House original.
Crimes Of is a weekly series that explores a new theme each season, from crimes of the paranormal, unsolved murders, and more. Our first season is Crimes Of Infamy, the true crime stories behind Hollywood's most iconic horror villains.
Listen to and follow Crimes Of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Radio Rental. The scariest stories you've ever heard in your life. All told by real people. And off we go.
This wasn't a human being that I saw. There's something here in this house. Something not of this world.
There was a woman moving through the hall. I stepped back and I was completely alone.
Radio Rental is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.